So back when I was in seventh grade, before we, all of us, had a phone in our pocket, I went with my youth group to Carlsbad Caverns, and we went down into the belly of this huge cave, and something unexpected happened down there. Now, some of you have heard me tell this story, at least part of the story. So we're down in this cave, and we're in a big room. They call it the big room. It's 8.5 acres of room. Seton Hospital could fit inside this, 4,000 feet from end to end. We're in this big room when something odd happened. The park ranger came on the loudspeaker and said she was about to turn off all the lights, and bam, she did. And the place went black, pitch black, darker than any place I had ever been before, and since, really. My eyes went to work right away, trying to zoom in and squeeze out just a shadow of light. But there was no light to be had in this room. It was uncomfortable. The darkness quickly became disorienting. In fact, it made me queasy. And I wasn't sure what to do with what was going on when all of a sudden, off that way in the distance, I heard a familiar sound. Psh! The park ranger lit a match. 6 football fields away in that room, she lit this tiny wooden kitchen match. And then something happened that I hope I never, ever forget. That room, every bit of that room, 8 acres of darkness was folded back and swallowed up by the tiny flicker of the flame on top of that match in the park ranger's hand, 6 football fields away. That tiny flame filled the entire place with light. You know, it doesn't take much light to overcome darkness, does it? And if you and I knew that before, we are so darn quick to forget it, aren't we? Light, every time, overcomes darkness. We easy to forget, even on a journey to the cross like this. And so we come into this place, or places like it. We come in here to remember that light, a teeny bit of light, makes all the difference in the world. And on our walk this year to the cross, on our walk past the cross, because you know that guy didn't stay on the cross. The light went to the cross, a couple of days of darkness, and then joy came in the morning and the light came again, and now that light keeps coming. It's now in your hands and my hands, and we can reflect it if we choose into the darkness of this old world, if we choose. I'll never forget that time in the cave. Something like that happened here 2 Wednesdays ago. Cheryl and I picked up these bowls. These bowls have what's left of last Sunday or last year's Palm Sunday ashes. We melt these things, we burn them, and we turn them to ashes. And some of you came forward, and Cheryl and I plunged our finger into these ashes, and on your forehead we made the sign of the cross. And we spoke these words to you: from dust you have come, looking you in the eye. From dust you have come, to dust you shall return. Thanks be to God, we said. And I haven't been the same since. In fact, that night, I knew something was different because I had to wipe tears away from my eyes. That's never happened to me before. Half my life, been a part of that kind of service. It's different. And I caught Alana out front, or Alana caught me, or we ran into each other out there. And do you remember what you said? You said, what you said there with the ashes, I believed you in a way I never had before. And I don't know what I said back to you. I hope what I said was, me too. 11 days later, that's what I say too, me too. And I have never been more grateful for those last 4 words. Thanks be to God. They're a bridge. They arch our entire lives. The death that is ahead, and it keeps going. Thanks be to God. Somehow those 4 words helped me hear with new clarity that God walks with us through the shadows of the valleys in our lives. Even death's tall shadow, death's recent shadows. Deborah, who is a friend of mine who is a hospice chaplain, like all good hospice chaplains, pushes open hospital room doors and bedroom doors, and she walks right into the pain in people's lives, right into the heart of their pain. Like the neighbors across the street, our firefighters, they do the same thing, which is our job too, y'all. By whatever light we're given, this is our job. Deborah, 6 years ago, was assigned chaplain to a six-year-old boy who had been diagnosed with cancer and was now dying of cancer. After months and months of treatment in the hospital in the city, his parents had now taken him out to the family ranch, to their home, where he could die by their side in his home. The boy had grown to distrust caregivers, all of them. He told his mom and dad plainly, "Make those people stop messing with me, please." The mom and dad were getting desperate. The doctor visited, the nurse visited, the social worker visited, and the boy refused care from every one of them. The situation was becoming a health crisis. If the boy didn't allow that hospice team to care for him, the doctor was afraid she was going to have to move that boy back to the hospital to die against his parents' wishes. But now it's Deborah's turn. That's what Deborah pushed the door open to. So she started the long drive out to the boy's ranch. And every mile, she said, every mile, my worry got bigger and bigger that I was not going to make a difference in this boy's life or in these parents' lives. I was our team's last chance to give those parents their final wish for their son's life to die peacefully at home. And so I prayed, "God, I do not want to go. God, you know that I can't do any of this out of my own power. God, please, please give me the words or what you'd have me do when we get there." After many miles driving on a straight Texas ranch road, she saw in the distance a tiny store, a little ranch store. It didn't take her much to convince herself to stop. The ranch was still about 5 miles out. "A break, I'm going to pull in." She goes in the place, and up and down the two aisles of merchandise she went, stalling, really. She checked out the entire place, all two rows, back and forth, when an idea hit her. Bribery. Bribery. I'll get the kid a toy, and I can use it as a peace offering, maybe to crack the door. And so she went to look up and down the two aisles of the store. She looked everywhere in the store, and all she found was one toy in that place. And it was a matchbox car in terribly faded packaging. Oh, the thing wasn't a sports car. It didn't have glittering paint. It didn't have those big old wheels that spun on it. It was an ice cream truck. An ice cream truck? What are the chances a six-year-old boy will think this is cool, she said. I was desperate, and so I paid that $1.95, and I picked up that ice cream truck, and I started the journey out to the ranch. The boy's father met me out the door, she says, with no light in his eyes. Deborah visited with the parents in the kitchen, and she learned that these two parents were angry with God. They couldn't talk with their boy about what was next because they weren't sure anymore if they could believe in heaven, being through what they'd been through. Deborah understood. The dad said, "Well, ma'am, sorry, there is nothing you can do. And I'm sorry that you had to make this long drive out here." The dad put his head down, and Deborah, defeated, put her head down too. And she looked into her bag, and she goes, "Well, I have a gift here for your son." And she pulls out that ice cream truck in the faded packaging, which was almost pink now, and sets it on the counter. She said, "I was about to melt in the heat of my insecurities, like ice cream on a warm day, when I saw the parents starting to smile." The parents looked at the gift, and then they stared at the gift, and then their smile took over their face. She said, How did you know? With tears in their eyes, the mom said, "How did you know?" Deborah didn't know. "What are you talking about? How did you know the ice cream truck is my boy's favorite? He loves the ice cream truck." The dad didn't speak. He just came around the counter and gave Deborah this huge hug, light coming back into his eyes, she said. "Well, I'm surprised the ice cream truck comes all the way out here, y'all." And the dad, still smiling, says, "Well, you know, our boy had never seen an ice cream truck till we took him down to that hospital in the city. And every day, out our window, we'd see that ice cream truck pull into the parking lot of that hospital. So We asked the boy if he wanted to go down. And every day, he mustered enough strength to pull himself into that wheelchair and go with us outside into the parking lot. It's the only time he went outside. And we all had ice cream out in that parking lot. The mom says it was the only joy in his day. He looked forward to it. He endured a great deal of suffering because of the promise of something sweet ahead of him. Deborah said every day that mom and dad took their boy out to the ice cream truck, it was a few moments to feel whole. It was a few moments to feel free from the pain, to be themselves again. So Deborah put her hand back on that ice cream truck. And the dad went in the boy's room and told the boy that a friend was here to visit and she'd brought him a gift. And the boy said, bring her in. And so she went in. Deborah went in along with all of the hospice caregivers from that day forward until he did die a month and a half later at home with his mom and dad right by his side. And you know, that ice cream truck was never very far from his hand. How long do you imagine that ice cream truck hung in that store out there in that little Texas ranch? How long had it hung there? Fading away, waiting? How long? And then Deborah, stalling, picked that thing up off a rack in a two-aisle store and put it in that boy's hand and opened the hearts of two parents and heaven wide to that small little boy. It doesn't take much light, y'all. By whatever light you are given, by whatever light. Even out at a two-aisle ranch store at the end of a lonely Texas ranch road, by whatever light you are given. In Greece, on the Isle of Crete, over a rocky bay, sits an institute dedicated to peace and human understanding. The thing is dedicated also to rapprochement between Germans and Cretans, which is an improbable task, given the bitter residue of wartime and what happened there. The location is important because it overlooks the small airstrip down on the beach where the Nazi paratroopers descended and attacked, invaded, really. The locals had nothing, and so they fought back with kitchen knives and hay scythes. Well, the German retribution was terrible. Populations of whole towns were lined up and shot for assaulting Hitler's finest troops. And now, high above that institute, sits a cross on the hill on this side, an iron cross marking the mass grave of the people who lost their lives there. And on the other side is the regimented tombstones of the German paratroopers who came in there. These two monuments are so placed so that everyone could see and no one would ever forget. Hate was the only weapon the Cretans had in the end, and it was a weapon they vowed never, ever to give up. And so how in the world does an institute dedicated to healing the wounds of war, dedicated to peace, how does it show up in a place like that? Well, the answer is one man, one life, Alexander Papaderos, which is a great name, Alexander Papaderos. Papaderos is a politician. He has a degree in theology or in philosophy. He's a lay theologian. He grew up most of his life in Athens, but he's a son of Crete's soil. Papaderos came to believe that the Germans and the Cretes had much to give one another, much to learn from one another, that they had an example to set. For if they could fashion a creative relationship, if they could learn to forgive each other, and people anywhere could do this, right? Well, Papaderos succeeded. The Institute became a reality on the ground of horror and putrid hate, an institute for peace. And it has been successful. Books have been written on the dreams that were sparked there, and these two cultures are now very good friends, which you probably already know. Robert Fulghum, who's a Unitarian preacher and writes a ton of books, All I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, that guy. He writes this book, I Was on Fire When I Laid Down on It. And in it, he tells this story. Fulghum says, one look at Papaderos, and you could see his strength and his intensity. His energy, his physical power, his intelligence, his passion just radiated from the guy. And to speak with him, to shake his hand, to be in the room when this guy spoke was to experience his extraordinary electric humanity. Few people live up to their reputation when you get right up close, Fulghum says. Alexander Papaderos was the exception. So on the last session of the last morning of a two-week seminar on Greek culture, Papadouros got up from his chair in the back of the room, and he walked around to a window that was wide open, and brilliant Greek sunlight was spilling in, morning light. Fulgham says, we watched his eyes as he turned and looked to the cemetery at the top of the hill, and he just stood there for a moment. Brilliant light streaming in. Then he turns and makes the ritual gesture. Are there any questions? Fulgham says, quiet, quilted the room. 2 weeks had generated enough questions for a lifetime, but now there's only silence. No questions? Papadouros asks, sweeping the room, looking everyone in the eye. Well, Fulgham loves little windows of opportunity like this. And so he says, I got a question, Dr. Papadouros. Sir, what's your question? What's the meaning of life? People chuckle, thinking it's a joke, because it's half a joke, but he's halfway serious. People start gathering their stuff, getting ready to go, but Papadouros puts up his hand and stills the room, and he says, I will answer your question. When I was a boy, we were very poor, and we grew up in a village not too far from here. I came up upon a wreckage of a German motorcycle. And I found these pieces of the mirror, and I tried to fashion these mirror back together, but I couldn't. And so I kept one piece of this mirror, and I made it round, about the size of a quarter. He's fished this thing out of his wallet, and now he has it in his hand. I took this thing out, and I would reflect light into dark places. It became kind of a game to me to get light in the most inaccessible places, into dark closets, into deep crevices. But as I grew, it wasn't just a challenge. It became a metaphor for what I might do with my life, he says. I became fascinated by the fact that I could reflect light into dark places, into places where the sun would never shine, into dark closets and deep crevices. Then I kept the mirror, and I have it now. He says, I've come to understand that I'm not the source of the light, but the light is out there. And it will shine in many dark places only if I choose to shine it into those places. I'm just a fragment of the mirror, he said, whose whole design and shape I do not know. Nevertheless, with what I have, I can reflect light into the dark places of this world and into the black places of human hearts. And I can change some things in some people. Perhaps others may see and do likewise. This is what I'm about, he says. This is the meaning of my life. And then Papadouros took that small mirror, and in that morning light, he took it and reflected it right onto Fulgham's face for a few moments. And then he redirected it where Fulgham's hands were sitting folded on the table. Friends, this is exactly what the calling Isaiah wrote down for you and me. Arise, shine, for your light has come. Thick darkness blankets the people, but the glory of God has risen on you. Nations will come to the brightness of your rising. You will see and you will be made whole. You will be radiant. Get up and shine. You know, this is almost exactly what Jesus of Nazareth said in the text, Matthew. You are the light of the world, he said. You are the light of the world. And he's talking to you and you and you. You are the light of the world. You're not the source of the light, but the light is there. And it will shine in many dark places only if you choose to reflect it there. It will shine in many dark places if you choose to reflect it there. The world is dying, and it is crying out for light. And I have sent it, says the Lord. Shine it now into the places that are dark. Here's the deal, God says. I shine, you reflect. And old Isaiah is right. It takes deliberate getting up. It takes purposeful aiming of our reflected light if we're going to make a difference at all in this old world. Because the darkness of this world is aggressive. The darkness is militant when we do nothing. When we, you and I, do nothing, we, you and I, guarantee the malignant growth of the dark. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hatred cannot drive out hatred. Only love can do that. And this is our calling this day and every day to the cross, to Easter Sunday morning, to this day, to tomorrow. This is your calling and my calling with whatever light we are given. Thanks be to God. Thanks be to God. Will you pray with me? So we're on our way to the cross again, dear God. And we'll walk with you through this valley and the next valley and whatever valley you have before us, if you'll walk with us by whatever light you give, help us follow. Amen.